second. Welcome, everybody. And I'd like to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that LC 2455 be introduced as a committee member or measure.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved that LC 2455 be introduced as a committee member or measure. And to be clear, voting for introducing a measure does not necessarily indicate that you would be supportive of a measure. Erin, can you just give us a brief summary of what this does?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 2455 specifies terms and conditions of employment required of employers that enter into contracts with port, requires employer to provide employees with written notice of rights granted under Act and to maintain certain employment records, authorizes imposition of penalties for failure to comply, prohibits discipline or discharge of employee for filing complaint under Act and makes retaliation against employee unlawful employment practice, authorizes civil action for violation of this Act, prohibits waiver of provisions of Act except as provided in collective bargaining agreement.
All right. Any discussion or objections? Leader McLean.
Not having read it, but only heard the summary, I'm looking forward to a vigorous debate, but today's a courtesy yes only for me, and look forward to actually getting to read it.
Great, thank you. Any other discussion or objections? Hearing none, the LC is introduced and close the work session. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2208. Erin, can you explain the measure?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2208 adds civil code enforcement officers to public officials who may request exemption from required disclosure under public records laws of specified personal information. The measure defines civil code enforcement officers. We have no revenue impact. We have no fiscal impact yet on the measure.
Okay, and Representative McEwen.
Good afternoon, Chair Hoyle, Vice Chairs Smith Warner and Gilliam. I'm delighted to be here today on behalf of a constituent that comes from the northern part of my district. Members of the committee, thank you. I'm Kathy McEwen, I represent House District 9, and I have a constituent at the north end of my district who lives in Yahats, who is a code enforcement officer, and I'm bringing this bill on his behalf. Mr. Niskanen first came to me last fall with a concern about personal safety protections for code enforcement officers. This was something I hadn't given any thought to, but since have become much more interested in this issue. Currently, certain public safety officials, police officers, and other law enforcement officers are eligible to have their personal information removed from the public record. However, despite the fact that code enforcement officers regularly enforce local regulations, which can result in private citizens acting in a retaliatory and threatening manner, code enforcement officers are not eligible to have their personal information hidden from the public record as other officers are. Mr. Niskanen has helped put together a group of local code enforcement officers that are here today to testify on what has now become House Bill 2208, and I would be more than happy to turn the dais over to them to explain the situation further from a more personal perspective. In their regard, I also might mention also that Ms. Amy Joyce and LC Dexter Johnson have had a conversation about an interface with the DMV here. There may be an amendment coming to clarify that. That conversation is occurring as we speak, so you may see an amendment coming. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. And with that, I would like to call up Don Niskanen, Dory Pierce, and Lisa McGill.
Should be Don.
Oh, sorry. And by Dory, I meant Don. Sir, could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Don Pierce. I work for the City of Hillsborough as a code enforcement officer.
Here, you want to just bring that microphone up a little closer so everyone can hear you?
Okay. My name is Don Pierce. I work for the City of Hillsborough as a code enforcement officer. I've been in that capacity for, well, since 2003, 12 years.
And did you want to tell us something about the bill?
I thought you just wanted me to introduce myself.
No.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I have a little bit of a story. Chair Hoyle, thank you, and Vice Chair Smith, Warner, and Gillen, appreciate your time. As I said, I've been working for the City of Hillsborough for 12 years in the capacity of a code enforcement official. And I don't know if you know that much about code enforcement work, but we tend to be an evolving profession, and it can be assigned under the planning department, the building department, the mayor's office. I myself am assigned under the police department. And we work hand in hand with a patrol. We face similar risks, and we fulfill similar duties. And what I have found that, whether it's like a crime that's being committed or a civil infraction, you tend to deal with the same sort of people, because the people that are committing thefts, burglaries, selling drugs are also the same people that allow their dogs to bark. They're scrapping vehicles for money in the middle of the night. They tend to get into more arguments and fights. And so when there is a call through dispatch that needs the attendance of a police officer, often it involves code enforcement as well. And I would like to point out that if you ever talk to a chief of police and you ask them what is the frequent call, the most common call, they don't get calls that say, hey, I'm so tired of the kidnappings. I'm so tired of the rapes. What do they call about? They call about, I'm tired of my neighbor's dog barking. I'm tired of the graffiti. I'm tired of people living in somebody's shed. And when we go to address those situations, they're the same people that are committing crimes in our community. And so we face the same sort of risks. In effect, code enforcement is law enforcement. It's the same thing. But police officers, they tend to enjoy another layer of anonymity, that they don't have to have their personal information available for upon public request. And what I'm appreciative is that you're considering to put civil code enforcement officers in the same category to be protected. I myself personally have been threatened many times. In fact, I've never owned a handgun until 7 years ago because of a case I was working on. And it's not just about personal safety, it's also about well-being. People that have your address, I have a long driveway that goes to my house, and I've had people hang fishing weights by fishing line just at the level of my windshield. One guy got creative and went to the local bookstore, and you know those annoying cards in the middle of magazines? Well, he got them all from every magazine, and soon I was receiving subscriptions to Field & Stream, Popular Mechanics, Ebony, Vanity Fair, everything. It took me a long time to cancel all those subscriptions. So it's not just about personal safety. It's about personal well-being, keeping the tires inflated, keeping your car from getting keyed. And so I'm really anxious and hopeful that you'll consider this.
Hi, my name is Lisa McGill. I'm a code enforcement officer for the City of Coos Bay, and thank you for having allowed me this opportunity to be present and give some testimony with my fellow association members. I've been enforcing for the last 8.5 years for the City of Coos Bay. I originally started out in public works, which led me into a very vulnerable situation of near attack, removed from a vehicle. And it wasn't even the person I was dealing with. It was a person walking by that just had it, just snapped. I had no means of getting help, taking off on a vehicle, not know if I ran them over, but trying to get back to the public works to have them shaken up back to City Hall to find out that person had followed me down to City Hall and wasn't done with me yet. That's the type of conflicts we run into. They become personal, and with that becomes retaliatory measures. And our safety right now, as far as our private homes, our public information, is everything open book. I've had to unlist my phone number. I quit using my checks at the grocery stores because they're looking at it going, oh, you know. So we have, or I myself is taking measures to protect my personal information as well. And I hope that this bill or measure will look at the our how vital it is for our safety. In my situation, too, with law enforcement, I was moved to the police department side for my own safety. And when I'm going to the homes of meth users or repeated code violations, now I'm able to know what I'm walking into, and I have police backup. And when they escort me on properties, I'm escorted by law enforcement. And where they're protected, where their information is, but mine's open. So I'm on scene, either, you know, DHS, complaints, law enforcement, but my information is public record. Thank you.
Sir, identify yourself for the record.
My name is Donald Niskanen. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the House Rules Committee for allowing us to speak to this legislation. I'd like to give a special thank you to Representative Caddy McCune for sponsoring this bill, and for Representatives Gomberg and Lively for co-sponsoring the bill. I'm the code enforcement officer for the city of Yahats on the Central Coast and a member of the Oregon Code Enforcement Association. Civil code enforcement officers are first responders, same as emergency personnel and law enforcement officers. Oftentimes, we are the first responders arriving before emergency and law enforcement. Because of the nature of our work, compliance with city and county codes and ordinances, they don't meet the medical emergency or criminal activity that would call in these other resources. When we knock on the door for a violation of an ordinance, we never know what to expect. We seek voluntary compliance, and in most cases, and it's out of ignorance of the ordinance, compliance is promised. However, that is not always the case. Our association has examples of harassment of civil code enforcement officers just trying to do their job. Oregon has not had any fatalities. California has. These are with code enforcement officers. We are asking that House Bill 2208 be adopted and ORS 192.501 and ORS 312.030 be amended to include civil code enforcement officers, allowing them the option of having their personal information, home address, home telephone numbers, etc., be made unavailable to the general public at sites like the DMV or tax assessor's office. I received a complaint about an individual who had a Land Rover and a trailer with a jet ski parked in the same place for multiple weeks. I went by to talk to this individual. He was very abusive, swearing and cursing. As he left in his vehicle and with both of our windows rolled up, I could still hear him swearing. I told him I would tag that vehicle if it wasn't moved within a short period of time. And our code allows for 72 hours in one spot, then it has to be moved to another place. The 72 hours expired. I went over there. I tagged the vehicle. I left. I went home to do some computer work. When I came out, the tag was taped to my vehicle in my driveway on my property. And due to the experience with him in the past, it made me very alert. He has since moved from the area, which was good for me. Another example, I represented the city in multiple municipal court hearings. And this was over an illegal vacation rental posing as a nonprofit idea. I insisted that we have a armed, uniformed sheriff's deputy in the courtroom for all of these proceedings. The man was very unstable, even though he was professional. Most of us are not sworn in law enforcement officers. Most of us do not carry weapons or tasers. Some of us carry pepper spray, but that won't stop a bullet. It may give us a little time to escape. Protecting our private information gives us a small measure of safety for our families and ourselves. The Oregon Code Enforcement Association and our individual officers would appreciate your support of House Bill 2208. Thank you for the time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there any question from the committee? Thank you very much for sharing that. We really do appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Amy Joyce from ODOT.
Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce. I'm from the Department of Transportation. I've submitted a piece of written testimony. It should be up on OLIS. Not included in that testimony, but what I want to say is that to start after that very compelling testimony is that the response of the agency is in no way any kind of comment on whether these officers should be included in protections under the law. The department has some fairly mechanical concerns about the bill that I wanted to express. And while Representative McEwen mentioned that I'd already spoken to Ledge Counsel Dexter Johnson, we haven't yet met to communicate, but she's authorized me to have that conversation with Ledge Counsel, so we'll be pursuing that. So the bill really does two different things, and I didn't hear both parts of the bill mentioned. So one of them is adding civil code enforcement officers to the list of folks who are receiving this protection under the existing law. So there's law enforcement or public safety officers, and now adding code enforcement officers. But also in there, it expands the list of entities that need to protect these records. Under the current law, it is DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, county and taxation records, and voter registration records. Those are the types of records that are protected under current law. What the bill does is it adds in and all state agencies. And as defined in the statute, all state agencies includes not only the departments, the boards, the commissions, it includes the courts, it includes the Secretary of State's office and the State Treasurer's office. So there's a possibility that the bill was drafted somewhat more expansively than was intended. And where that impacts the agency is in two ways. The first is the DMV. So there's a whole section in ORS Chapter 802 that deals with DMV records. It's quite extensive, state law, federal law. And one element statutorily created is a program to allow a whole host of public employees to use their work address in lieu of their residence address. And so the concern for us is with this bill that it would require us to create a whole separate program when there's an existing program that works very well. And, you know, if civil code enforcement officers would need to be added to that laundry list, you know, that's great. But there's a program that works very well and is an existing statute. The other piece, too, though, for all of ODOT, not just the DMV, is we respond to public records requests frequently. Sometimes they're quite voluminous. Sometimes those records include people's addresses. An example I would give you is right-of-way acquisition. So we buy strips of property for a project. We pay the owner. Sometimes the negotiations are lengthy. A person's address, phone number, name might be in that, all over in that file. That could happen 2 years from now. It might have happened 10 years ago. But if there's a public records request and we turn over that file, now we need to be, because that state agency piece has been added in this bill, now we need to be reviewing all of our disclosures and public records requests for any kind of address on a list, and we're not sure where we'd get the list of civil code enforcement officers. Would that be supplied to the state and would be distributed to all the agencies, courts, and other offices? Would it come just to ODOT? So there's some mechanical things is all I'm saying, where, again, perhaps the bill was drafted more broadly than was intended, and certainly DMV has an existing program that works well.
So, and it is my understanding that this bill was drafted more broadly than intended, and we're not moving the bill today. Specifically, we wanted to hear the bill, have people have a chance to read it, deal with these concerns. And again, if we're going to pass something, we certainly want to make sure we get it right. Are there questions? Yes.
Under the current bill, Amy, it indicates that the home address and home telephone number expanded to the code enforcement officers contained by DPSST and any other state agency. Couldn't somebody, if you wanted to find out the home address of a code enforcement officer, simply run the name through your new database and look up voter database rolls, which is public? I mean, isn't that a loophole?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I think you're referring to the new motor voter bill. So two things there. One is we're not creating a new database under that bill. DMV has particular records on people, name, address, age, citizenship, and whether that data is exchanged with Secretary of State is an item for consideration by the legislature, but we DMV, ODOT, have not created a new database. Secondly, folks under that work in lieu of address, specifically, that is now their address in DMV records, is their work address only. So it is completely substituted for their home residence address. So that is a protection.
Just a question, point of order. So the names that are shielded, like law enforcement officers, which is what these people are asking to be included, those names that are shielded will not be transferred over to the Secretary of State's office if they're under domestic violence victims or law enforcement officers. That was my understanding. Is that not correct?
Chair Hoyle, I'll need to recheck on that. I came prepared to talk about this bill, not a different bill.
That's totally
fair.
And
so I can certainly get an answer immediately for the committee on that.
All right, follow up then. In the examples that we're just giving, other than the one of them, I don't think any of our code enforcement officers who spoke, the perpetrator of the harassment had time to get their contact information, except in one of the examples there would have been. How much time does it take to get in information? For an example, if our chair, Majority Leader Hoyle, was a code enforcement officer, and she kind of acts like one, frankly, at times, but if she did, if she was a code enforcement officer, and I wanted to find out where she lived, how long would it take me to get that information?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the question. Are you talking about a response to a public records request?
Yes.
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I think it would all depend on the size of a public records request. I mean, we as ODOT receive public records requests that end up being a single sheet of paper or boxes and rooms full of paper. It all depends on what the request is. And then again, ODOT records, you know, we don't, it would be, in my example, for instance, in a right-of-way file. So it's not, you know, lists and lists of names and addresses, but, you know, the address happens to be on a property file from a right-of-way acquisition from 15 years ago.
May I follow up? Let me ask a question another way. If I wanted to find out our chair's home address through ODOT, how long would that take me?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I don't know. It would depend completely on the nature of the public records request.
Let me try to ask another way. If do you ever receive requests for certain drivers' information from members of the public?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I assume that DMV does receive such requests.
And how long does an average request take to fill?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, well, first of all, most folks aren't eligible to receive the information. So if somebody comes up to the counter at DMV or sends in a letter requesting information, there's very specific entities in the statute who are allowed access to DMV information. So that's the starting point, the request. You know, if it's just one person asking for another person's information, isn't necessarily going to be released. DMV has a records office and a records expert who deals with such requests. There are also entities called integrators that largely work with insurance companies, and voluminous records are released to insurance companies through an electronic system. And again, that's an item in the statute that allows DMV to release that information to those entities.
Anybody? Are you going to follow up again?
I'm going to just try to get this question answered. I must be asking it improperly. Maybe Amy could come see me afterwards. Here's what I want to know. we have folks saying, you need to protect us. I'm asking the question of, well, how long does it take to get their information? And typically people get it through DMV requests or others when it comes to trying to find people's personal information. So that's all. Is it a year? Is it 10 years? Is it one day? Sure. If I want to get someone's address through you, I just want to know, how long does that take?
Chair Hoyle and Representative McLean, I have to respectfully disagree with you when you said when people want to find people's address, they go to DMV. I would disagree. Most people are not entitled to the address from DMV.
Okay.
Not Rayfield.
Then why I would do just we need kind to of, and it's not really a question, but just kind of a quick point. Most folks would go to the county assessor and look at property records, and I think this bill is am I understanding that this would also affect property records and getting that information in a public records type setting where their address would be, say, at a county clerk, and you may or may not know the answer to that?
Well, Chair Hoyle and Representative Rayfield, from reading the bill, it adds code enforcement officers to those three existing entities, one of which is the county real property assessment and taxation records.
Follow up. And most of those county assessor records are actually available right now on the internet to be able to find people's addresses.
Chair Hoyle and Representative Rayfield, I'm sorry, you'd have to ask someone else that question.
Okay. Ms. Joyce, thank you very much. Unless there's any other questions.
I would just comment, if I could, Madam Chair. I don't know if this will be helpful to my colleague, but at least in your question, I would recommend you go to Eugene and you follow the searchlights and the signs that say Vote Hoyle. You can find her like that.
To my district.
Are you saying there's only one in the district?
Oh, yeah. No. But they all lead there.
And with that, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 2208. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386. Erin, can you explain the measure?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 386, repeal sunset on current public records disclosure exemptions for persons engaged in or providing goods or services for medical research using animals other than rodents at Oregon Health Science University. This measure comes to you from your Senate with a 29-1 no vote. There is a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay, with that, I would like to call up Phil Donovan, Jason Davis, and Nancy Hagwood. However you want to do it, just
Thank
make
you,
sure
Madam
to
Chair.
Identify yourself before you start speaking.
All right.
Well, after you start speaking, before you start testifying.
For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you, Madam Chair, for scheduling this bill for a hearing today. I think, as all of you know and appreciate, OHSU has world-class research programs. But, of course, we can't attract and retain the best and brightest to Oregon if they are not safe. And that is what led to the researcher safety law that was created in 2003. It's limited redaction authority provided to Oregon Health and Science University for protections for their researchers and their families and their colleagues without jeopardizing public transparency. Senate Bill 386 simply lifts the sunset. It doesn't make any changes to the law itself. It's been in place for over a decade. And since it was last renewed, we've had 3 years of continuing to receive animal record requests and processing them without complaint. So here to talk with me today about the law itself is Jason Davis, who's legal counsel at OHSU. And here to talk about the importance of this to the researchers at the Oregon National Primate Research Center is Dr. Nancy Hagwood. She is the director of that facility, as well as a researcher who is doing some really exciting work in the field of HIV treatment and vaccines. I've had an opportunity to tour her lab. It's inspiring work. But first, let's give it over to legal counsel.
Chair Hoyle, Vice Chairs Smith, Warner, and Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Jason Davis. I'm legal counsel at Oregon Health and Science University. As was just mentioned, this bill will lift the sunset on the researcher safety law. It makes no other changes to the law. The researcher safety law allows OHSU to exempt the following information when the public requests information about the research being conducted with non-human primates or researcher whose work includes non-human primates. So it exempts the name of the OHSU employee or researcher, the home addresses of the OHSU employee or researcher, and the name and address of companies that provide goods and services for non-human primate research, such as companies that raise animals for research purposes or supply food or caging. The public still receives all other information regarding proposed or ongoing research, including the specific description of the research or scientific proposals, the justification for the use of the animals in the research, plans for the animals' well-being and care, highly detailed records of the care actually provided to the animals, and the terms and conditions of the contracts and payments made with the companies that we contract with. The reason this law is in place is because extremists have used public records requests to get the names of research personnel and connect them to specific projects. They then use this information to fuel support for intimidating and violent acts against individuals and their families. The researcher safety law is not intended to keep animal research records from those who request them, but rather removes the name and addresses to prevent the intimidating and violent acts against individuals and their families. The detailed records outlining the care and use of the animals remains available. We believe this law provides a balance between the needs of the public to get good detailed information about the care and use of the animals while protecting the individuals and their families from the threat of violence. And for those reasons, we urge you to support the removing the sunset on this bill. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Hagler.
And yourself.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hoyle and members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Nancy Hagwood, and I am the director and the senior scientist at the Oregon National Primate Research Center at OHSU. I'm also an adjunct professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at the same university. On behalf of the scientists and the animal care staff, I want to thank you very much for hearing my testimony in support of Senate Bill 386. This bill is very important to me and to my colleagues, and we appreciate your interest. Before I speak to the importance of the bill, I'd like to quickly just provide a bit of background as to what we do. We are a research facility, and we do world-class research in neuroscience, pathobiology and immunology, infectious disease, and reproductive sciences. And our researchers, technicians, veterinarians, and animal care staff are all working hard to find treatments and cures for deadly and costly diseases. A couple of examples in the last several years include uncovering new avenues for fighting AIDS in babies who contract the disease from their mothers. Secondly, developing a vaccine that shows promise in preventing AIDS, and that looks like it will go into clinical testing in 2016. And finally, a new gene therapy method that could someday prevent devastating genetic mutations from being passed from mothers to their children. In the process of doing this research, we are keenly aware and dedicated to the health and well-being of our animals. Our dedicated staff members provide around-the-clock veterinary care, ensure that our primates are provided with nutritious meals and enrichment activities, and we maintain clean, disease-free environments. There's a very strict and rigorous scientific protocol that any research study has to go through before anything is tried on a non-human primate, almost as strict as human protocols. And those studies that make it through the process, we think, can advance medicine very significantly. As you know, the use of animals in research and treatment and well-being of these animals is a regulated process that's overseen by the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, that is, the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. In addition, we're overseen by the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, which we call the IACUC. I know you needed to know that. And the Federal Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare, or ORLA, to whom animal care incidents must be reported. The work of an individual researcher and staff and the way that they use and care for their animals are closely scrutinized at all levels. Much of our research is funded by tax dollars, and as such, we feel we have a responsibility and an obligation to inform the public about the goals of our research and the advances that we make every day to improve human health and well-being. We welcome public scrutiny of this process, and we have community outreach programs to educate the public and the community about what we do. Unfortunately, tactics by some animal rights extremists, whom we define as individuals who use illegal and menacing means to incite violence against scientists, have changed. The FBI has documented a shift in tactics from targeting institutions to targeting individuals, that is, individual scientists and their families, including their homes and their personal property. Over the last 11 years that this law has been in place, the ability to redact the names and addresses of people and businesses involved in animal research has helped protect me and my colleagues from experiencing the property damage and intimidation that have occurred in other states. I believe the release of public records without individual names provides meaningful access to detailed public records, as you've heard, without compromising the safety of individual researchers, staff, and their families. Thank you.
Perfect. Any questions? Yes. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Davis. I'm intrigued that you only asked to have the sunset removed after 11 years of experience. That suggests that evidently the current standards are sufficient and inadequate.
The current exemption as worded?
I was surprised that you didn't have some form of an upgrade is what I was
saying. No, we felt that the exemption as stated has been effective to protect our scientists, and so for that reason we decided that just removing the sunset would be valuable.
Any other questions or comments? No, thank you so much. And with that, I would call Mr. Barringer and Mr. Basler. Panel with all the B names. A lot of things that could be said, but I won't say them. B list. Wait, go ahead. I wasn't going to say it, and then I forgot and said it. Go ahead.
Representative Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon AFSCME. When we testified together in front of Senate Judiciary, he called us hired guns. I say humble servant of the people of AFSCME, but whatever. We represent 24,000 members across the state, and about 116 of them work at the Primate Center at OHSU. Our members are not the scientists. We love the scientists, but not the scientists. We take care of the primates, the feeding, care of the animals. Our workers truly care deeply about the animals. They like to tell stories where they can look across the Primate Center and tell who's not feeling well and who needs care right away. But their names are all over the information that could be requested. They're the ones, they may make a check or a mark off every time they feed, every time there's a different situation. And in California, there's documentation that it's not just the scientists who have been attacked, but the people who also work and take care of the animals. So we think this is a really important bill for their safety and for the work they do. But that's pretty much all I have.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association, and we represent over 8,000 physicians, physician assistants, and medical students in the state. Our members benefit from this research, but also our members are some of the researchers that are conducting the research at the Primate Center. And the strength of our members' ability to continue to provide that care and do that research definitely depends on the quality research that's done at OHSU and around the world. And that's only going to be done if people are safe in doing that research. These Oregonians are performing lawful and federally regulated research, and they deserve to be safe, their families, their children, themselves, and their homes. So with that, we'd also encourage you to pass Senate Bill 386.
Any questions or comments? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any additional testimony on this particular bill? None. So we can either move this today if there's no objection because we're simply lifting a sunset. It's not a new law if people are comfortable with that. Otherwise, if you'd like more time, we can do that. But is everyone comfortable with moving this today? We're good? Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing and open up the work session for Senate Bill 386. I'd accept a motion at this point.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 386 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam moves Senate Bill 386 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion or objection? If not, the motion passes. Representative Smith-Morner, would you like to be the carrier? Thank you. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 386. Okay, and with that, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3037. Erin, will you explain the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3037 modifies public records law exemption from required disclosure of certain personal information of public employees and public body volunteers to remove mandate for disclosure upon showing that public interest would require disclosure in particular instances, require certain personal information of home care workers, operators of child care facilities, exempt family care providers, operators of adult foster homes, and those who have submitted voluntary information in confidence to public body be maintained confidentially and not disclosed pursuant to a public records request. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You do have a dash one amendment for consideration, which excludes Oregon Judicial Department and Oregon Department of Transportation or any records in their custody from public records disclosure exemption for home care workers, operator of child care facility, family child care providers, and operator of adult foster homes. There is a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact on the measure with the amendment before you.
Okay, I am going to testify on this and going to hand the committee over to my able vice chair.
What about me?
Or Representative Gilliam, whoever.
I thought it was going to Smith Warner. Excuse me.
Colleagues, the reason
Val Hoyle. I'm sorry, could you identify for the record?
Representative from House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. Colleagues, the reason I'm bringing this bill forward is at the request, after hearing the stories from some child welfare workers, their jobs are very difficult. They work in highly emotional situations to do what's best for the child, and oftentimes over the objection of the guardian. And right now, their personal information is considered public record. So there are things that should be public record, as we've recently seen with a number of emails. So if you're doing public work, the content of those emails should be public. Now, these workers also have their, they have their job title, they have how much they're making, they have, you know, where they work. That is public record, and that's settled law. But what this does is protects things like their Social Security number, their address, their cell phone number, their personal and private information. Because when someone has that much information, it can put someone like a child health, a child welfare worker in danger. And I think you'll hear some stories that are very, very compelling. This would impact three different types of people. People work for the public body, so child welfare workers, people that work at OYA, people that collect child support, things like that. People that work indirectly for the state, like home health care workers. Right now, these workers don't have protection of basic things like their Social Security number. And then finally, a separate part of this bill is people that do business with the state, for instance, get their realtor's license or get, you know, other kinds of licenses, they have an expectation that things like their personal cell phone and their email address, their Social Security number will be kept private. So this would mean that that information wouldn't be transferred over in a public records request. It has been brought to our attention that Section 3 was much more broad than intended, so we put in an amendment to narrow this out. So it would be the opt-out that public workers have, so it does not impact the court, judicial, or DMV records. With that, we have some other testimony that I think is quite impactful, but I'm happy to take questions.
Are there any questions for our former chair? Representative McLean.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle, you mentioned that Social Security numbers would be protected. I think they already are, though. So maybe I don't have the right bill. It's 3037. Is there a dash one that's out there somewhere? I don't have the dash one.
And to be clear, we're not. It's 3037, and we're not passing the bill today. We're hearing the bill today, and then we'll make sure that you get all the information.
So in addition to dash ones, we're going to look at other...
Just dash ones.
Dash ones address the Section 3 thing right. You mentioned. Okay.
Exactly.
Follow up. In Section 1 of the bill on page 1, would that apply to all public employees?
It would apply to all public employees.
So this bill goes beyond, if I may follow up.
Please.
Goes beyond family care providers. This actually would affect every single public
right.
employee.
And this is, again, what is personal information versus what should be public information. And again, there's a lot of information that is public. Any of the emails, any communication that we do in working for the public, that is public record. But this really is information that that should be kept private.
And then could I have one last
Please.
Follow-up question? Then I may need some more understanding on this, because our public employees are required to either be a part of SEIU or pay fair share payments. Does SEIU have access to personal emails of all these people?
I'm not sure what SEIU has access to as part of their as part of a membership organization. So if somebody is a member of a union, they would have an ability to contact those members. And as does the state has the ability to contact those people that work for them. This is about people that don't have that interest to not be able to have access to people's private personal information.
So there's a difference between contacting them professionally, so to speak, and privately.
Yes, and again, I think the testimony that you hear will explain why we feel like this is urgent and important.
Other questions? If not, we thank you for your testimony.
Catherine Stearns, Lenny Gardner, and Doug Dryden. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Catherine Stearns. Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Stearns, and I worked for the state for more than 25 years. I worked in direct client services in the Department of Human Services, but today I'm here representing myself. I am in support of House Bill 3037. I don't believe that when I signed up to work for the public that my personal information should be public record to anyone who requests it. I understand that my name, my job, my workplace, my salary, and my retirement is public, but not my personal cell phone, my address with my family, or my other personal identification information, such as my driver's card number. During most of the years I worked for DHS, I also served as an elected union steward and officer of SEIU. In that capacity, I got to hear many sad stories of the child welfare workers and self-sufficiency workers losing their peace of mind during their off time from the work they do. I have no recollection of even being informed of my personal contact information being a public record. Even if I had been informed, I doubt that would have spelled out for me that my employment left me vulnerable to stalkers and death threats. When I worked as a DHS case manager, I was part of a multidisciplinary team focusing on the needs of long-term welfare recipients. A licensed psychologist coworker on this team informed me that one of our mutual clients threatened my life, and on more than one occasion, and the lives of my coworkers. We had reports that were later substantiated this particular client was a violent pedophile. For months while the investigation continued, I lost the ability to enjoy being out in my yard and garden or even doing my grocery shopping, as I felt so very exposed to a very real danger. There was no peace in my life until this person was incarcerated, convicted, and sentenced, and he did get 100 years. Granted, this is an isolated instance in my career with DHS. Similar scenarios are more frequent with protective services workers, especially in child welfare. Many of us do dangerous jobs. We go into people's home and take their children. We demand people pay child support. We arrest people, and every day we keep our community safe. It is important that we also feel safe and that we have a choice in what personal information is shared and not just automatically shared because we signed up to serve the public. I know that I signed up to have some of my personal information shared when I decided to serve the public. I just think I should be able to have my own privacy and safety as well. Chair Hoyle and committee members, thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I am Jenny Garner. I'm a recently retired child welfare worker and worked for 15 years for the state of Oregon. Of those 15 years, 6 years I spent as a child protection service worker. There were times when my job was to assess the safety of children in homes where people were actively using drugs, people were mentally ill, people were had criminal activity. At times, I also had to determine that children were not safe in those homes, remove the children, and frankly, that's something that even a rational person would become angry and anguished about. The job was risky, and I was frequently subjected to verbal abuse as part of the job, but I was lucky. I only had one incident happen in my career where someone actually came to my home, and that turned out to be a client who was showed up at my house one evening wanting money. It could have been a very different scenario. I had a couple of workers who received death threats that were determined to be very valid death threats based on the previous activity of the people making those threats, threats both against themselves and their families. And while that was targeted towards those specific people, everyone in our work group feels the impact of those threats. I have, throughout that entire 15 years, no one ever pointed out to me the fact that that my personal information was subject to public information request. And probably it wouldn't have made a lot of difference in whether I did my job or not or stayed with the job. But in looking back at it now, I think I don't mind having someone know where I work or how much money I make or what my retirement is, my public email, my public phone. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem with having that personal information be so easily accessible. So I'm asking for those who do the same work that I did, other occupations in the state that have the same level of risk from public retaliation, to please protect that personal information. And I ask for your support of this House Bill 3037. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the House Rules Committee. My name is Doug Dryden. I'm Chief Steward with SEIU Local 415, which is affiliated with the Oregon Youth Authority. I live in Philomath, and I currently work at the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany, and previously at the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Grants Pass. I'm here as a representative of the Union Executive Committee to express our support for House Bill 3037. In these situations, I'd like to keep my remarks brief. I hope you entertain the same perspective. I have to believe this bill reflects a problem that did not exist in the first place. While I agree with the need for transparency in our government, a point driven home again with the events of the previous month, we must agree that there is a rational limit. Just as freedom of speech must be tempered by limits on slander, advocacy of a violent overthrow or insurrection, or yelling fire in a crowded theater, so must the extent of transparency not extend into areas of privacy that were never really intended to be breached. There are those who would take litigious advantage of those who would consider loopholes in the original bill, and we appeal to you to forestall these attempts. In the case of Oregon Youth Authority, for example, the general public tends to be wholly unaware that the age of those supposed youth in our charge extends to the age of 25 and includes those under Measure 11 and all crimes that we've found on the rolls of those inmates in the Department of Corrections. Indeed, half our population is assigned to us by way of Department of Corrections. At my advanced age, I have in previous careers, just as in this one, been subject to threats in a variety of languages against my life and family. While none fortunately have come to fruition, the result has been due in good part to a healthy regard for security. And the coverage that this bill provides enhances that security. I have found that when someone threatens to kill you, you need to take that seriously. This protection has already been recognized in law enforcement and correction agencies. For example, the address publicly available through one's driver's license can be modified through opt-out to reflect the work address instead of the home address. In some agencies, this is a requirement. Failure to add the security provisions of this bill would fly in the face of those policies. In this light, I strongly encourage you to pass this bill on to the floor for a favorable result. Thank you for your time and your kind consideration.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you. Question, sir, with regards to SEIU, on page one of the bill, 3037, I do want to note that dash one does not change this section, so I want to address this section. It lists in section one, subsection three, line 17, and includes a bunch of information that would apply. Does SEIU have access to the personal electronic mail addresses of public employees?
To follow up on your previous question, yes, indeed. SEIU and also AFSCME represent some portions of OIA as well. But when someone signs up for the union, we're compelled by law to be at least a part of the union in this state, but you actually sign up to become a part of the union. When you sign that form, you're asked for an email address for simple purposes of communication. Some provide their work email, some provide their personal email, but that's entirely voluntary on our part.
May I follow up? On those who choose not to be a part of the union but are required by law to make payments to the union nevertheless.
Being a fair share, I presume?
Yes. Are they required to give any of the information listed in Section 3 of Section 1?
No, sir, they are not.
Okay. And do you have in your possession, I assume you have some of this information on people who either are part of the union or paying fair share payments?
Not at my fingertips, but no, we do have access to who belongs and who does not.
I know, but do you, may I follow up? But do you have, for an example, the personal emails currently?
For those who've volunteered to supply the best we have.
So what
for
would
those members?
I guess as a follow up, does SEIU do they have a policy about releasing information?
We don't release information.
And
that's our policy.
Okay, so I guess the broader question I would have is there anything in subsection 3 of section 1 that you're aware that your union has of fair share payers? And if not, what information do you have on them?
If I may intercede here, I don't believe we're prepared to answer that question because we are members, but we are not part of the staff that manages that data. And I think the question would be better directed at someone who actually has the answers.
Well, that's why I asked him.
Right. I think that's fair, but I think what I heard was that emails, mobile phone numbers are voluntarily supplied if asked, but more importantly, are not subject to public record requests for people's personal information. You never transfer that information over. Is that correct?
Not to my knowledge. To clarify, I'm an elected union official. That doesn't mean that I'm a professional.
And I can call someone up after this that would be in a better position to answer the question. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, there is someone.
Yes, I will.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
But the, to be a member, you fill out a form. If you elect to go fair share, you do not fill out that form. Therefore, you're not subject to providing that information at any rate.
So,
all right, thank you.
With that, I will call up.
Chair?
Yes. Yes.
I just want to say thank you to my lovely constituents for taking the time out of their day to come here and advocate on issues that are important like this that not only are going to help you guys, but many other folks. So thank you.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to call Melissa Unger up so that you can address some of the questions that have been asked, and then we'll call up the rest of the people that are here to testify. Identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. Sorry, I think he introduced himself as a union steward, but is not actually staff member for the union, so is a member at the Oregon Youth Authority. And so I don't think he necessarily knows all the kind of differences in the information that we get. So I think the question was what kind of information we as a union get about our members and people who pay fair share, who do pay into the union. And all of that is collectively bargained with the state about what kind of information we get. And so that's how, and it depends on the collective bargaining agreement. But we do get information on who they are. And as they are, like I said, members of our union and do pay into our union. So we do get information because they do that. But it's all, most of it's work information about where they work, their work address, what their job is, how much they get paid, that kind of information.
So, and one other question. Previously, we had a question about Social Security numbers. Are Social Security numbers already private? And if so, why would it be in this bill? Or are there for certain sectors of the workforce for which their Social Security number is not private?
So currently if, in the bill, and I don't have in front of me, but that public employees, people who work for a public body, currently their Social Security number is private. It's not subject to a public records request. But the other part of the bill where you have a bunch of different workers who indirectly work for the state, whether it's home care workers or child care workers or adult foster care workers, they don't currently have any of those exemptions that are currently called out in the public records law that they do for the public workers, so the direct public workers. And so currently their Social Security numbers are not protected under the current version of the public records bill. So this bill adds in Social Security numbers for those indirect employees. And so that was the confusion, is that there's two different parts and it impacts it in two different ways because they're currently written into the law in two different ways.
Ms. Unger, so on page one of this bill, does subsection 3 of section 1 expand this to every single public employee?
Yes. Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, and thank you very much, committee assistant, for handing me a copy of the bill. That was really helpful. So what this this section 1, subsection 3 does is that currently there is an exemption for public and body employees or volunteers for their Social Security number and their birth date. This adds to that list of things that they're not available for public record. So it really adds what personal information is available for public record that now adds into personal address, residential, personal cell phone number, personal electronic email address, all of those things. So it adds that into it for all public employees.
Okay, may I follow up?
Yes.
So does SEIU obtain any of this information from fair share payers?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, yes, we get some of this information through a collective bargaining agreement.
And may I follow up? Would this law prevent the state from disclosing that subject to a collective bargaining agreement?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, no, it would not.
So members of the public or the press or anyone else wouldn't be able to get it, but SEIU would be able to get it if for fair share payers if it was subject to a collective bargaining agreement?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, my understanding, and I will have to go back and talk to our lawyers because I did not write this bill, nor do I necessarily understand all of the information that we get because I'm not a part of the collective bargaining agreement. My understanding is that there is the collective bargaining agreement, since folks pay into our union and are members of our union or fair share members of our union, that they actually pay dues into our union, that the way that we have information is different. I will have to go back and clarify to make sure I understand that correctly, because I don't know what the difference is for members versus fair share when they sign up. When so once somebody becomes a state worker and they sign up as a member, they can opt into getting a lot of, they opt into most of their personal information. So they give us their personal email, they give us other information. We don't have that on everyone. So I'm not quite positive which information is public, like what we get automatically and what people opt into. I'll have to go back and do some follow-up, but I can get that follow-up to you.
Can you get that information to us? If you get it to Erin, she will get that information to all
of us. I can
do
that. I'll make sure that I get an opinion on it.
Right. Yes.
Ms. Unger, is the information that would be expanded for non-disclosure for all public employees that's set forth in subsection 3 of section 1, is any of that information available through voter records?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, I'm not an expert on what is available through voter records. I do know that some of that information is public. I think there is a huge difference, I believe, in a public employee's public information when you know where that person works, you know what that person's salary is, you know what that person's, like what that person does for a living, than a random request for an address. I do think there is a difference in a public employee's information being public when you have all that information about who they are. Than a voter address being available. But I don't know what of this information is available because I'm just not an expert on the public records law for voter registration.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now for the original people who originally signed up to testify, Twyla Pugh, Stephen Hammond, and Harry Ferdahl. Did I get everybody's name right? Okay, good.
As close as anybody's going to get my last name.
All right. Well, then I think you should introduce yourself first so we can know how to pronounce it.
Excuse me. Hi, my name's Carrie Fardall. I am a clinical dietitian, and I work at the Oregon State Hospital. So I'm here to represent all of my coworkers at the state hospital. We work with a mentally ill population, many of whom have been charged with crimes. And many of them are extremely upset with their commitment and oftentimes take that out on my coworkers because they are the ones that are directly taking care of them throughout their stay. So we actually have some of our previous residents who have been known to gather information of hospital employees and oftentimes are found after their discharge back on campus stalking some of our coworkers. So we are very much in favor of supporting the additions to the current law to strengthen the privacy of our personal information, particularly in this day and age where, honestly, just internet access can not only get our personal information, but then it can be used as far as spyware and stalking when you don't actually have to be near an individual. So keeping our phone records, our phone numbers private, our addresses, just keeping us safe from those who have been known to actually come after and try to, retaliate, get revenge for the care that they were placed at the state hospital.
Excellent.
Yep.
Yourself.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Twyla Pugh. I'm a child protective services worker for the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program out of Lane County. I appreciate your time today to listen to this information. I spend my career trying to protect children. I've worked for the state for 9.5 years. Of that, 3.5 have been with Child Protective Services. I, in addition to wanting to protect other children, of course, I want to protect my own. There was a particular incident that came in 2011 where I was unable to protect my daughter and felt very helpless. Due to child safety concerns, I removed an infant from a parent and who was mentally ill and using methamphetamines. She ended up making threats against me, and approximately 2 weeks after the removal, ended up sitting in my driveway and trying to get my attention by blaring her music, honking her horn. I was not home, fortunately, at that time. However, she did describe my mother-in-law's pickup, who was parked in my driveway, as well as my house. I, as well as the governor's advocacy office, the current caseworker who had it after me, and myself received phone calls from her where she said that she was in my driveway. She was driving by my house multiple times. She would like to kill my daughter so that I could find out what it was like to live without a child. She called me and left a message for me on my phone and told me that she was going to set my house on fire and sit outside my house and shoot us as we came out one by one. This didn't just end there. I did go and file for a stalking order. I asked my program manager, one of my program managers, to have the Department of Justice assist me in being there in case there was a trial that commenced if she showed up. I was told at that time that I would not get the help because what would the public perception be if we spent the state's money in something that's like this? So I ended up having to retain my own attorney and pay $600 out of my pocket to protect my family as best I could. I was granted the stalking order. However, she violated it and left a message for my supervisor saying, either you take care of her or I will. She was convicted, but it's only a misdemeanor because it was the first time. That was in 2011. In 2013, approximately a month after my mother passed away, I get a phone call from one of her ex-roommates saying, I don't know who you are, but I feel that you need to know. I have seen pictures of your home, pictures of your daughter. She described my daughter to me. She described my house, vehicles that I drive. She was also able to explain how this parent sat day in and day out at a computer trying to search ways to get back at me and had all this information about me. It's very disconcerting when I can go out on a day-by-day basis and remove children out of unsafe environments, but I can't protect my own. Most recently, my daughter is now 11. At the time that this happened, she was 8 years old. I had to explain to her that she couldn't go out in the front yard and play. I live in a very small community of only 1,000 people. Until then, she could go out. I live on a dead-end street. She was playing in the front yard and in the street and could ride her bicycle. She couldn't be out there without anybody else out there. We don't have a law enforcement agency in my town. I have to rely on the sheriff's department, who are very understaffed. My daughter, after this person was arrested for violating the stalking order, I printed out her picture off the internet, off the jail website, and I showed it to her as well as took it to her school and said, if this person comes, she's not allowed to take her. I explained to my daughter. My daughter drew pictures of her and explained to me how she was going to protect me by taking care of and harming this lady so that she couldn't come. That's nothing that an 8-year-old should have to do. We have since been through counseling. She's getting better, but there are times I still look out the window when a car passes my street because we don't have any vehicles driving up and down our road. I constantly think that it's her. I've had to put curtains on windows that I never had curtains on before. And we spend most of our time in our backyard instead of out front where we used to participate with our neighbors. Currently, I'm actively looking to sell my house and move to another address so that hopefully she won't be able to find me. I thank you for listening to my story today, and I do hope that you take that into consideration when thinking about passing this bill.
Thank you. Sir.
My name is Stephen Hammond. I'm also a Child Protective Services worker in Lane County with Ms. Pugh. We actually work in the same office and have been doing CPS services for the same amount of time. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for your time today. I don't know that I have anything to add that hasn't already been shared with the committee by other social workers. I had to experience an incident with a particular family who moved from various states over short periods of time to different countries and projected a facade that they had a significant amount of money by owning a $750,000 motorhome, two brand new cars, and a home that was on the river up the McKenzie Highway in Lane County. The limited information we had on this family was that they had avoided other authorities in other states. They were extremely isolated and had three young children. The father was a gun nut, and upon my initial visit to the home, talked about previous contact with child welfare in other states and how they had come onto his property without permission and how he had been able to see them through the scope of his rifle. Later, we were able to get access to the home after the family had fled and found that he had indeed had two gun safes as tall as I am. Empty containers of items that had made it apparent that he had modified illegally his weapons. So we were dealing with, as far as we understood, individuals who had who had unlimited sources of funds and unknown activities. When they were found in Washington and their children removed, the mother in the case began making threats online. The initial threat was a statement that was similar to, you can only take so much from a man before he decides you shouldn't have anything either. And accompanying that post was a picture of a person in crosshairs. And she proceeded to post additional veiled threats to myself and to other people involved with the case. In my particular situation, her post was, you have to determine what causes are more important to you. For instance, I love Issa, do you? Issa is the nickname of my six-year-old daughter. Her name legally is Isabel, and she's only called Issa in our house because we pronounce her name Isabel because my wife is Hispanic. She proceeded to make other posts in regard to my supervisor, in regards to DOJ employees. As my colleagues have pointed out, this isn't a lot of the information that we're talking about today can be found online. But what I feel is important not only is a message to myself and to my fellow caseworkers is that there are limits, that the work we do is important and that we are important and that our safety is important and our family safety is important. And also to the community at large, that they cannot just get this information, that the state stands by us and what we do and says these people are important, they deserve to be protected. So that if they do make these requests for information, it's not as easy to get it. It's a small token, but it's something. The impact it had on my family when I came home and told my wife that there had been a post online about our daughter, she was in tears. And she ended up leaving the state for a week, pulling my daughter out of school. I also had to take pictures of these individuals to my daughter's school to keep an eye out for them. And we purchased a gun. We live not far from Miss Pugh, actually, out in the countryside, and only have law enforcement in Lane County sheriffs to rely on. My wife at the time and still is providing daycare services for young children that are 2, 3, that don't understand if they are outside playing, if there's an emergency and they need to be brought inside immediately. So it's been an extremely stressful couple of years for our family. And this is but one small thing that can be done to protect myself and other caseworkers in our positions.
Any questions for this panel? No. Thank you very much. And Joe Basler, last but not least.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, a little bit least, probably.
Yeah.
My name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon AFSCME. We also represent a number of state workers, public employees. I don't have a lot to add. I simply wanted to put out there that this is one of the public employees have to disclose a lot of information. It's public record of how much they make, where they work. Most of their neighbors don't have to disclose what their income is. Publicly, and they do. And I can tell you that this sort of disclosure, they get email from their personal emails that the state has, they get solicitations often, and it's one of the number one complaints I get from members. So we just kind of want to add our voice out there. I don't have a lot more information than Melissa does, but feel free to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Yes. Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And please do not interpret this as a lack of support for these bills, because I'm very impressed on the importance of these bills today, particularly from the panel we just heard from. I just wanted to say to you, but also to the committee, I hope there is, in addition to what we do here through this bill, a way for us to encourage particularly our state departments and their training facilities, as well as union folks, the importance of their job, the possibility of the kind of stories we just heard, and how, for instance, how important social media is, particularly if you're going to take a job along the lines that we were described to us. Of course, we want to do our part to prevent that, but reiterating to folks at the training point that you are vulnerable and you should be careful, and I think several of folks said there's other ways to get this information, but I don't know if it should be in the bill. I don't know if it's just simply us encouraging department heads, but I just wanted to get that on record and suggest that to you as well.
Sure. Well, Representative Gilliam, just to add is Department of Corrections, we represent the Department of Corrections. It's such an important part of the things we tell our members, our child care providers, who we also represent. It's part of the training that we do for those members. It's really kind of scary, and we work very hard on it. Thank you.
Yes, Leader McClain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The dash one. See, we've got two things going on here. I just want to focus on the section one, subsection three. If you could get the chair to distributory committee the answers to the questions that I asked Ms. Unger about SEIU would be, what information does the union have on public employees, and distinguish at least those who were members and those who are required by law to pay fair share of payments to your union. And I'm specifically interested in, when you look at the amended information, we already prohibit, obviously, disclosure of Social Security numbers, et cetera. But we're expanding that prohibition, and I'm curious as to what AFSCME has on that list.
Chair Hoyle, Representative McClain. Absolutely. I was hoping via email to have that ready for you when I came up, but I did not get a response yet. But as soon as I do, I will make sure that I get it to Chair
Hoyle. Get it to us so we can get it to the entire committee.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
I have one more, Madam Chair.
Okay.
If you'll permit me, I wanted to make one other comment. I'm pleased that we don't have an indication of a large fiscal, but I have to say I want to be sure we examine that, particularly when I hear us say we're adding as many folks as we're adding. And I'm not, again, suggesting that they not be added. And then lastly, I want us to keep in mind, not looking backwards, looking forward, are we sure of our capability in these areas of data process? You would say in this case, this is redacting things, but the interface and the input I'm so technical, you know that, of the input of new information and dealing with the overlay of different computer systems concerns me, particularly when it comes to the safety of these folks. So let's make sure that either we feel good about our state capability to do this sort of thing, or that we're negotiating properly with professionals that can help us, because we don't want to come back with a glitch that did just the opposite, for instance, in a particular department. It exposed some information inadvertently that we were trying to protect or some other thing like that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions, comments? All right, thank you so much. So just, and I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3037. Reminders, there is no meeting on Rules Committee meeting on Wednesday, March 4th, but there will be a meeting on Friday, March 6th. And with no further business, we're adjourned.
I think that's it. There'll be a meeting. You see, there'll be a meeting. You see, I think that's it.